To the average educated Briton in the material Victorian era, a man who claimed to be able to produce results which upset Newton's law of gravity, and which showed invisible mind acting upon visible matter, was prima facie a scoundrel and an impostor. The view of spiritualism pronounced by Vice Chancellor Giffard at the conclusion of the Home Lion trial was that of the class to which he belonged. He knew nothing of the matter, but took it for granted that anything with such claims must be false. No doubt similar things were reported in far off lands and ancient books, but that they could occur in prosaic, steady old England, the England of bank rates and free imports, was too absurd for serious thought. It has been recorded that at this trial Lord Giffard turned to Holmes' counsel and said, "Do I understand you to state that your client claims that he has been levitated into the air?" Counsel assented, on which the judge turned to the jury and made such a movement as the high priest may have made in ancient days when he rent his garments as a protest against blasphemy. In 1868 there were few of the jury who were sufficiently educated to check the judge's remarks, and it is just in that particular that we have made some progress in the 50 years between. Slow work, but Christianity took more than 300 years to come into its own. Take this question of levitation as a test of Holmes' powers. It is claimed that more than 100 times in good light before reputable witnesses he floated in the air. Consider the evidence. In 1857, in a chateau near Bordeaux, he was lifted to the ceiling of a lofty room in the presence of Madame Ducos, widow of the Minister of Marine, and of the Count and Countess de Beaumont. In 1860 Robert Bell wrote an article, Stranger Than Fiction, in the Cornville. He rose from his chair, says Bell, 4 or 5 feet from the ground. We saw his figure pass from one side of the window to the other, feet foremost, lying horizontally in the air. Dr. Gully, of Malvern, a well-known medical man, and Robert Chambers, the author and publisher, were the other witnesses. Is it to be supposed that these men were lying Confederates, or that they could not tell if a man were floating in the air or pretending to do so? In the same year Holmes was raised at Mrs. Milner Gibson's house in the presence of Lord and Lady Clarence Paget, the former passing his hands underneath him to assure himself of the fact. A few months later Mr. Wasson, a Liverpool solicitor, with 7 others, saw the same phenomenon. Mr. Holmes, he says, crossed the table over the heads of the persons sitting around it. He added, I reached his hand 7 feet from the floor, and moved along 5 or 6 paces as he floated above me in the air. In 1861 Mrs. Parks, of Cornwall Terrace, Regent's Park, tells how she was present with Bulwer Lytton and Mr. Hall when Holmes in her own drawing room was raised till his hand was on the top of the door, and then floated horizontally forward. In 1866 Mr. and Mrs. Hall, Lady Dunsany, and Mrs. Senior, in Mr. Hall's house saw Holmes, his face transfigured and shining, twice rise to the ceiling, leaving a cross marked in pencil upon the second occasion, so as to assure witnesses that they were not the victims of imagination. In 1868 Lord Adair, Lord Lindsay, Captain Wynne, and Mr. Smith Barry saw Holmes levitate upon many occasions. A very minute account has been left by the first 3 witnesses of the occurrence of December 16th of this year, when at Ashley House Holmes, in a state of trance, floated out of the bedroom and into the sitting room window, passing 70 feet above the street. After his arrival in the sitting room he went back into the bedroom with Lord Adair, and upon the latter remarking that he could not understand how Holmes could have fitted through the window which was only partially raised, he told me to stand a little distance off. He then went through there, open space head first quite rapidly, his body being nearly horizontal and apparently rigid. He came in again feet foremost. Such was the account given by Lords Adair and Lindsay. Upon its publication Drive Carpenter, who earned an unenviable reputation by a perverse opposition to every fact which bore upon this question, wrote exultantly to point out that there had been a 3rd witness who had not been heard from, assuming without the least justification that Captain Wynne's evidence would be contradictory. He went the length of saying, "A single honest skeptic declares that Mr. Home was sitting in his chair all the time, a statement which can only be described as false." Captain Wynne at once wrote corroborating the others and adding, "If you are not to believe the corroborative evidence of three unimpeached witnesses, there would be an end to all justice and courts of law." To show how hard put to it the critics have been to find some loophole of escape from the obvious, they have made much of the fact that Lord Lindsay, writing some time after the event, declared that it was seen by moonlight, whereas the calendar shows that the moon was not at that time visible. Mr. Andrew Lang remarks, "Even in fog, however, people in a room can see a man coming in by the window, and go out again, head first, with body rigid. It would seem to most of us that if we saw so marvelous a sight we would have little time to spare to determine whether we viewed it by the light of the moon or by that of the street lamps." It must be admitted, however, that Lord Lindsay's account is clumsily worded, so clumsily that there is some excuse for Mr. Joseph McCabe's reading of it that the spectators looked not at their object itself and its shadow on the window sill, but that they stood with their backs to it and viewed the shadow on the wall. When one considers, however, the standing of the three eye-witnesses who have testified to this, one may well ask whether in ancient or modern times any preternatural event has been more clearly proved. So many are the other instances of Holmes's levitations that a long article might easily be written upon this single phase of his mediumship. Professor Crookes was again and again a witness to the phenomenon, and refers to 50 instances which had come within his knowledge. But is there any fair-minded person who has read the incident here recorded who will not say, with Professor Shelley, "Either the facts must be admitted to be such as are reported, or the possibility of certifying facts by human testimony must be given up"? Are we, then, back in the age of miracles? Cries the reader. There is no miracle. Nothing on this plane is supernatural. What we see now, and what we have read of in ages past, is but the operation of law which has not yet been studied and defined. Already we realize something of its possibilities and of its limitations, which are as exact in their way as those of any purely physical power. We must hold the balance between those who would believe nothing and those who would believe too much. Gradually, the mists will clear and we will chart the shadowy coast. When the needle first sprang up at the magnet, it was not an infraction of the laws of gravity. It was that there had been the local intervention of another stronger force. Such is the case also when psychic powers act upon the plane of matter. Had Holmes' faith in this power faltered, or had his circle been unduly disturbed, he would have fallen. When Peter lost faith, he sank into the waves. Across the centuries, the same cause still produced the same effect. Spiritual power is ever with us if we do not avert our faces, and nothing has been vouchsafed to Judea which is withheld from England. It is in this respect, as a confirmation of the power of the unseen, and as a final answer to materialism as we now understand it, that Holmes' public career is of such supreme importance. He was an affirmative witness of the truth of those so-called miracles which have been the stumbling block for so many earnest minds, and are now destined to be the strong solid proof of the accuracy of the original narrative. Millions of doubting souls in the agony of spiritual conflict had cried out for definite proof that all was not empty space around us, that there were powers beyond our grasp, that the ego was not a mere secretion of nervous tissue, and that the dead did really carry on their personal unbroken existence. All this was proved by this greatest of modern missionaries to anyone who could observe or reason. It is easy to poke superficial fun at rising tables and quivering walls, but they were the nearest and most natural objects which could record in material terms that power which was beyond our human ken. A mind which would be unmoved by an inspired sentence was struck into humility and into new paths of research in the presence of even the most homely of these inexplicable phenomena. It is easy to call them puerile, but they effected the purpose for which they were sent by shaking to its foundations the complaisance of those material men of science who were brought into actual contact with them. They are to be regarded not as ends in themselves, but as the elementary means by which the mind should be diverted into new channels of thought. and those channels of thought led straight to the recognition of the survival of the spirit. You have conveyed incalculable joy and comfort to the hearts of many people, said Bishop Clark, of Rhode Island. You have made dwelling places like that were dark before. I have a mission entrusted to me. It is a great and a holy one. The famous Dr. Eliotson, immortalized by Thackeray under the name of Dr. Goodenough, was one of the leaders of British materialism. He met home, saw his powers, and was able soon to say that he had lived all his life in darkness and had thought there was nothing in existence but the material, but he now had a firm hope which he trusted he would hold while on earth. Innumerable instances could be quoted of the spiritual value of Holmes' work, but it has never been better summed up than in a paragraph from Mrs. Webster, of Florence, who saw much of his ministry. He is the most marvelous missionary of modern times in the greatest of all causes, and the good that he has done cannot be reckoned. When Mr. Holmes passes, he bestows around him the greatest of all blessings, the certainty of a future life. Now that the details of his career can be read, it is to the whole wide world that he brings this most vital of all messages. His attitude as to his own mission was expressed in a lecture given in London in Willis's Rooms on February 15, 1866. He said, "I believe in my heart that this power is being spread more and more every day to draw us nearer to God. You ask if it makes us purer? My only answer is that we are but mortals, and as such liable to err, but it does teach that the pure in heart shall see God. It teaches us that He is love, and that there is no death. To the aged it comes as a solace, when the storms of life are nearly over and rest cometh. To the young it speaks of the duty we owe to each other, and that as we sow social we reap. To all it teaches resignation. It comes to roll away the clouds of error, and bring the bright morning of a never-ending day." It is curious to see how his message affected those of his own generation. Reading the account of his life written by his widow, a most convincing document, since she of all living mortals must have known the real man, it would appear that his most utterly whole-hearted support and appreciation came from those aristocrats of France and Russia with whom he was brought into contact. The warm glow of personal admiration and even reverence in their letters is such as can hardly be matched in any biography. In England he had a close circle of ardent supporters, a few of the upper classes, with the Halls, the Howitts, Robert Chambers, Mrs. Milner Gibson, Professor Crookes, and others. But there was a sad lack of courage among those who admitted the facts in private and stood aloof in public. Lord Brougham and Bulwer Lytton were of the type of Nicodemus, the novelist being the worst offender. On the whole came badly out of the matter, and many an honored name suffers in the story. Faraday and Tyndall were fantastically unscientific in their methods of prejudging a question first, and offering to examine it afterwards on the condition that their prejudgment was accepted. Sir David Brewster, as already shown, said some honest things, and then in a panic denied that he had said them, forgetting that the evidence was on actual record. Browning wrote a long poem, if such doggerel can be called poetry, to describe an exposure which had never taken place. Carpenter earned an unenviable notoriety as an unscrupulous opponent, while proclaiming some strange spiritualistic thesis of his own. The secretaries of the Royal Society refused to take a cab drive in order to see Crookes's demonstration of the physical phenomena, while they pronounced roundly against them. Lord Giffard inveighed from the bench against a subject the first elements of which he did not understand. As to the clergy, such an order might not have existed during the 30 years that this, the most marvelous spiritual outpouring of many centuries, was before the public. One cannot recall the name of one British clergyman who showed any intelligent interest, and when in 1872 a full account of the St. Petersburg stances began to appear in the Times, it was cut short, according to Mr. H. T. Humphreys, on account of strong remonstrances to Mr. Delane, the editor, by certain of the higher clergy of the Church of England. Such was the contribution of our official spiritual guides. Dr. Eliotson the rationalist was far more alive than they. The rather bitter comment of Mrs. Holmes is, the verdict of his own generation was that of the blind and deaf upon the man who could hear and see. Holmes' charity was among his more beautiful characteristics. Like all true charity, it was secret, and only comes out indirectly and by chance. One of his numerous traducers declared that he had allowed a bill for 50 to be sent in to his friend, Mr. Imer. In self-defense, it came out that it was not a bill but a check most generously sent by Holmes to help this friend in a crisis. Considering his constant poverty, £50 probably represented a good part of his bank balance. His widow dwells with pardonable pride upon the many evidences found in his letters after his death. Now it is an unknown artist for whose brush Holmes' generous efforts had found employment, now a distressed worker writes of his sick wife's life saved by comforts that Holmes provided, now a mother thanks him for a start in life for her son. How much time and thought he devoted to helping others when the circumstance of his own life would have led most men to think only of their own needs and cares. Send me a word from the heart that has known so often how to cheer a friend, cries one of his protégés. Shall I ever prove worthy of all the good you have done me? Says another letter. We find him roaming the battlefields round Paris, often under fire, with his pockets full of cigars for the wounded. A German officer writes affectionately to remind him how he saved him from bleeding to death, and carried him on his own weak back out of the place of danger. Truly Mrs. Browning was a better judge of character than her spouse, and Sir Galahad a better name than Sludge. At the same time, it would be absurd to depict Holmes as a man of flawless character. He had the weakness of his temperament, and something feminine in his disposition which showed itself in many ways. The author, while in Australia, came across a correspondence dating from 1856 between Holmes and the elder son of the Rymer family. They had travelled together in Italy, and Holmes had deserted his friend under circumstances which showed inconstancy and ingratitude. It is only fair to add that his health was so broken at the time that he could hardly be called normal. He had the defects of an emotional character, said Lord Dunraven, with vanity highly developed, perhaps wisely to enable him to hold his own against the ridicule that was then poured out on spiritualism and everything connected with it. He was liable to fits of great depression and to nervous crises difficult to understand, but he was withal of a simple, kindly, humorous, loving disposition that appealed to me. My friendship remained without change or diminution to the end. There are few of the varied gifts which we call mediumistic and Saint Paul of the Spirit which Holmes did not possess. Indeed, the characteristic of his psychic power was its unusual versatility. We speak usually of a direct voice medium, of a trance speaker, of a clairvoyant or of a physical medium. But Holmes was all four. So far as can be traced, he had little experience of the powers of other mediums, and was not immune from that psychic jealousy which is a common trait of these sensitives. Mrs. Jenkin, formerly Miss Kate Fox, was the only other medium with whom he was upon terms of friendship. He bitterly resented any form of deception, and carried this excellent trait rather too far by looking with eyes of suspicion upon all forms of manifestations which did not exactly correspond with his own. This opinion, expressed in an uncompromising manner in his last book, Lights and Shadows of Spiritualism, gave natural offense to other mediums who claimed to be as honest as himself. A wider acquaintance with phenomena would have made him more charitable. Thus he protested strongly against any stance being held in the dark, but this is certainly a counsel of perfection, for experiments upon the ectoplasm, which is the physical basis of all materializations, show that it is usually affected by light unless the light is tinted red. Holmes had no large experience of complete materializations such as were obtained in those days by Miss Florence Cook, or Madame d'Espérance, or in our own time, by Madame Bisson's medium, and therefore he could dispense with complete darkness in his own ministry. Thus, his opinion was unjust to others. Again, Holmes declared roundly that matter could not pass through matter, because his own phenomena did not take that form, and yet the evidence that matter can in certain cases be passed through matter seems to be overwhelming. Even birds of rare varieties have been brought into stance rooms under circumstances which seem to preclude fraud, and the experiments of passing wood through wood, as shown before Zollner and the other Leipzig professors, were quite final as set forth in the famous physicist's account in, of his experiences with Slade. Thus, it may count as a small flaw in Holmes' character that he decried and doubted the powers which he himself did not happen to possess. Some also might count it as a failing that he carried his message rather to the leaders of society and of life than to the vast toiling masses. It is probable that Holmes had, in fact, the weakness as well as the graces of the artistic nature, and that he was most at ease and happiest in an atmosphere of elegance and refinement, with a personal repulsion from all that was sordid and ill-favored. If there were no other reason, the precarious state of his health unfitted him for any sterner mission, and he was driven by repeated hemorrhages to seek the pleasant and refined life of Italy, Switzerland and the Riviera. But for the prosecution of his mission, as apart from personal self-sacrifice, there can be no doubt that his message carried to the laboratory of a crook or to the court of a Napoleon was more useful than if it were laid before the crowd. The assent of science and of character was needed before the public could gain assurance that such things were true. If it was not fully gained, the fault lies assuredly with the hidebound men of science and thinkers of the day, and by no means with Holmes, who played his part of actual demonstration to perfection, leaving it to other and less gifted men to analyze and to make public that which he had shown them. He did not profess to be a man of science, but he was the raw material of science, willing and anxious that others should learn from him all that he could convey to the world, so that science should itself testify to religion while religion should be buttressed upon science. When Holmes' message has been fully learned, an unbelieving man will not stand convicted of impiety, but of ignorance. There was something pathetic in Holmes' efforts to find some creed in which he could satisfy his own gregarious instinct, for he had no claims to be a strong-minded individualist and at the same time find a niche into which he could fit his own precious packet of assured truth. His pilgrimage vindicates the assertion of some spiritualists that a man may belong to any creed and carry with him the spiritual knowledge, but it also bears out those who reply that perfect harmony with that spiritual knowledge can only be found, as matters now stand, in a special spiritualist community. Alas, I that it should be so, for it is too big a thing to sink into a sect, however great that sect might become. Holmes began in his youth as a Wesleyan, but soon left them for the more liberal atmosphere of Congregationalism. In Italy, the artistic atmosphere of the Roman Catholic Church, and possibly its record of so many phenomena akin to his own, caused him to become a convert with an intention of joining a monastic order, an intention which his common sense caused him to abandon. The change of religion was at a period when his psychic powers had deserted him for a year, and his confessor assured him that as they were of evil origin, they would certainly never be heard of again now that he was a son of the true church. Nonetheless, on the very day that the year expired, they came back in renewed strength. From that time, Holmes seems to have been only nominally a Catholic, if at all, and after his second marriage, both his marriages were to Russian ladies, he was strongly drawn towards the Greek Church, and it was under their ritual that he was at last laid to rest at Street Germain in 1886. To another discerning of spirits, Icor, 12, 10, is the short inscription upon that grave, of which the world has not yet heard the last. If proof were needed of the blamelessness of Holmes' life, it could not be better shown than by the fact that his numerous enemies, spying ever for some opening to attack, could get nothing in his whole career upon which to comment save the wholly innocent affair which is known as the Holmes-Lyon case. Any impartial judge reading the depositions in this case, they are to be found verbatim in the second series of incidents in my life, would agree that it is not blame but commiseration which was owing to Holmes. One could desire no higher proof of the nobility of his character than his dealings with this unpleasant freakish woman, who first insisted upon settling a large sum of money upon him, and then, her whim having changed and her expectations of an immediate introduction into high society being disappointed, stuck at nothing in order to get it back again. Had she merely asked for it back, there is little doubt that Holmes' delicate feelings would have led him to return it, even though he had been put to much trouble and expense over the matter, which had entailed a change of his name to Holme, Lyon, to meet the woman's desire that he should be her adopted son. Her request, however, was so framed that he could not honorably agree to it, as it would have implied an admission that he had done wrong in accepting the gift. If one consults the original letters, which few of those who comment upon the case seem to have done, one finds that Holme, S. C. Hall as his representative and Mr. Wilkinson as his solicitor, implored the woman to moderate the unreasonable benevolence which was to change so rapidly into even more unreasonable malevolence. She was absolutely determined that Holme should have the money and be her heir. A less mercenary man never lived, and he begged her again and again to think of her relatives, to which she answered that the money was her own to do what she pleased with, and that no relatives were dependent upon it. From the time that he accepted the new situation, he acted and wrote as a dutiful son, and it is not uncharitable to suppose that this entirely filial attitude may not have been that which this elderly lady had planned out in her scheming brain. At any rate, she soon tired of her fad and reclaimed her money upon the excuse, a monstrous one to anyone who will read the letters and consider the dates that spirit messages had caused her to take the action she had done. The case was tried in the Court of Chancery, and the judge alluded to Mrs. Lyon's innumerable misstatements on many important particulars, misstatements upon oath so perversely untrue that they have embarrassed the court to a great degree and quite discredited the plaintiff's testimony. In spite of this caustic comment, and in spite also of elementary justice, the verdict was against Holme on the general ground that British law put the burden of disproof upon the defendant in such a case, and complete disproof is impossible when assertion is met by counter-assertion. Lord Giffard might, no doubt, have risen superior to the mere letter of the law had it not been that he was deeply prejudiced against all claims to psychic power, which were from his point of view manifestly absurd and yet were persisted in by the defendant under his nose in his own Court of Chancery. Even Holmes' worst enemies were forced to admit that the fact that he had retained the money in England and had not lodged it where it would have been beyond recovery proved his honest intentions in this the most unfortunate episode of his life. Of all the men of honor who called him friend, it is not recorded that he lost one through the successful machinations of Mrs. Lyon. Her own motives were perfectly obvious. As all the documents were in order, her only possible way of getting the money back was to charge Holme with having extorted it from her by misrepresentation, and she was cunning enough to know what chance a medium, even an amateur unpaid medium, would have in the ignorant and material atmosphere of a mid-Victorian court of law. The powers of Holme have been attested by so many famous observers, and were shown under such frank conditions, that no reasonable man can possibly doubt them. Crookes's evidence alone is conclusive. There is also the remarkable book, reprinted at a recent date, in which Lord Dunraven gives the story of his youthful connection with Holme. But apart from these, among those in England who investigated in the first few years and whose public testimony or letters to Holme show they were not only convinced of the genuineness of the phenomena, but also of their spiritual origin, may be mentioned the Duchess of Sutherland. Others who went so far as to admit that the theory of imposture was insufficient to account for the phenomena were Mr. Ruskin, Mr. Thackeray, then editor of the Cornhill Magazine, Mr. John Bright, Lord Dufferin, Sir Edwin Arnold, Mr. Heafy, Mr. Durham, sculptor, Mr. Nassau Sr., Lord Lyndhurst, Mr. J. Hutchinson, ex chairman of the Stock Exchange, and Dr. Lockhart Robertson. Such were his witnesses and such his works. And yet, when his most useful and unselfish life had come to an end, it must be recorded to the eternal disgrace of our British press that there was hardly a paper which did not allude to him as an impostor and a charlatan. The time is coming, however, when he will be recognized for what he was, one of the pioneers in the slow and arduous advance of humanity into that jungle of ignorance which has encompassed it so long. Chapter 10, The Davenport Brothers. In order to present a consecutive story, the career of D. D. Holme has been traced in its entirety. It is necessary now to return to earlier days in America and consider the development of the two Davenports. Home and the Davenports both played an international part, and their history helps to cover the movement both in England and in the States. The Davenports worked upon a far lower level than Home, making a profession of their remarkable gifts, and yet by their crude methods they got their results across to the multitude in a way which a more refined mediumship could not have done.